Hi everyone, welcome to the Talking Split podcast for week 5, I think we are, of this season. With me I have Justin Schuller and Mike Zeppel, the high performance coaches for Metro and Country. Welcome guys.
Rob,
good day.
Excellent. You can download this podcast on iTunes, Audio Boom, which I only just found out what that was this week. The Basketball Victoria website as well. Anywhere good podcasts are sold, you can get this.
How much are we charging on this thing?
Not enough. We need someone to come in here and drop the bag for us or something like that. Big thanks to those who have left ratings, reviews, who send emails in. A couple of people have reached out on Twitter during the week with some ideas on video editing, which was one of their previous episodes as well. So it's been fantastic to interact with those guys. Just to rehash, I'm on at Rob Calder on Twitter. Justin is...
JSchuller15.
And Mike is Black Ops.
Undercover. Got some grief in the office this week about my lack of Twitter, my lack of social media. So, look, this is what I thought, Robbie. We had 5,000 downloads last week of last week's pod, okay? If we can get, say, 50 people retweeting that this pod is alive, then I'll become operational on Twitter.
I like it.
That'll be a Zeppel selfie or something. That'll be his first post.
That'll be the debut right there. From the pod.
Probably one thing we do have to acknowledge to start off with. So obviously we had Dean Vickerman on the podcast last week. Anyone that hasn't checked that out really needs to go and have a listen because he was fantastic. Friend of the show, Dean Vickerman, I should say, of course. Big congratulations to him and by part, Justin, as well, for the Coach of the Year nod in the NBL just recently. That was this week, I think it was.
Tuesday night. NBL really put on a show and awesome that Dino got a great reward for how he's steered the team so far and with the good playoff run that we've had to date.
Well, that's very good. You've done that well, planning one week in advance. I like what you've done there. So again, big thanks to Dean Vickerman. We hope everyone gets behind Melbourne United, regardless of which state you're in, but obviously Dean's helped us out, so we're pretty keen to support him along the way. Absolutely. He did say off air, I suppose, that Zeppel was probably his least favourite Victorian athlete that he's ever coached.
I can't believe we turned the mics off on that point.
A little disappointing. Probably just touching on that as well, you guys caught the Boomers feeble games over the weekend?
Yeah, definitely. Like, boys had two really solid performances. I think, like all international events, we got tested for a while, but our sustained pressure, I actually heard Andre talk about that quite a bit through his press conferences, so it was clearly a focus for them, but sustaining pressure and finding that opportunity to have that moment to blow it out and some really good performances pretty much across the board.
I think it's just cool how the whole world on the same weekend is playing FIBA qualifiers. Like, it's very much that FIFA World Cup qualification feel. I know the USA played Cuba last weekend, like the same night or the same afternoon that we were playing here in Melbourne. So I think it's just cool what FIBA's done. And I think I heard that the women are going to go along that same trajectory moving forward as well. So I think it's a good move for our sport.
Yeah, definitely. And New Zealand, I think, are on top of their pool as
so they had a couple of good wins as well. So finally got over Korea, who's been their bit of a bogey team for a while. All we care about is that Korea smack those New Zealand boys around a bit and hopefully they come into the first final a little sore.
Always a vested interest. So big thanks to everyone that's contacted us with some topics. We've had a couple of emails over the last fortnight or so. We just, hey, can you talk on this? Or, you know, just sending some feedback on us, which is great. Hopefully the mics are going a little better than they were a little bit earlier. We are trying. We'll see how it plays out.
It's good that you finally turned them on, mate. It was funny.
This whole time I was on mute. It's sadly not your microphone, though, Justin. We can always hear you loud and clear.
Just with a nice, loud, bellowing voice, mate.
So one of the topics that came in from Coach Nicole this week is stats, data, and analytics, and how we use them in coaching. So this will obviously vary a little bit depending on which level of coaching you're at. Some will use stats to organise court time. Some will go a little bit deeper in that. The domestic level varies from the VJBL level to the senior level to the Australian level and international play as well. What do you track in games as a coach? So is there anything that you really value as a statistic that you will always have on your bench in games you coach?
I think it's important to recognise that basketball is a game of numbers.
Moneyball.
How you use the numbers depends on your philosophies as a coach, but I was taught a long time ago now when I was in the US that so much of the scouting report, so much of your planning, your recruitment, all of that is derived from the figures. How much you buy into that, how much, and we'll talk about how how you balance that up with the eye test and, you know, your philosophies, etc. But I think it is important that to recognise that there is some element of probability and numbers that come with our sport.
And again, it's to help your result. Yeah. So if you can really see the numbers for what they are, I don't think it's solely the thing you can go on. I think we spoke in a podcast a little bit back about how if you just look at the numbers, that can catch you out as well. But what it will do, if you've got a great sample size, will give you a true indication of, one, how does this team play? Two, what are the things we've got to be able to take away? And then three, well, what can we use to our advantage? And so to your question, Rob, what do we really track? Well, you can go all the way into it deep. You can do a shallow look at it. The reality is, if you're not going to use the numbers, there's not much point to it. So for me, like, my philosophy has always been around the 3-point game. So they're the first numbers I'm looking at a box score at quarter time, half time, three quarter time. You know, how many points are we giving up in transition? How many points are we giving up in second chance? So looking at the opposition's O boards, and is there a disparity there? And how many times are we putting them on the free throw line versus us? Like, that to me, they're the if we're in a real disadvantage in those three categories, that's what we've got to fix first. If that's not there and it's an even split or whatever it may be, well, then I look at other numbers from that. But that to me is the three areas that we've just got to be on top of.
Have you got numbers that you think are a good gauge? So if you look at half time, should we be here, here and here? Or is it a bit of a feel for the opposition style?
It's funny you say that, because when I started, it was like, here's my set number and that's what it is. But I think with the way the game is played now, it really is a game by game scenario. Yeah. And also, you know, what your opposition is trying to achieve. So, you know, if they're a team that sends five people to the glass,
right,
well, you know, then there's going to be a disparity there. And does that mean that we're actually doing well or not?
Mm.
There's other numbers we've got to look at. But so to me, it is definitely a game by game scenario.
So you probably spoke a little bit more about the other team, I suppose, and that. Like, I was always really big on, any time I got a box score at Nationals, I'd always check my stats first, in my team stats. The things I would usually look for is who's in foul trouble, who's shooting it poorly, and turnovers were probably the three things that I would always check in every game. I need to know, obviously, if someone's got three fouls, highlight that straight away, because that's a bit of an anomaly.
Yep.
And always look for the outliers. So if, you know, some kid's got up eight shots but missed, you know, seven of them, that's probably a bit of an anomaly. That, okay, most good players don't get eight shots up.
Yep.
If they're no good.
No, I like that. I mean, it's, you know, there is another side to it. Like, for me, how many threes are we putting up versus free throws? That's absolutely something I'll check each quarter and see if there's too big a disparity there, or if it's something that I feel we're on track with, or we could be doing better in that regard. I think field goal and 3-point shooting percentages, for us, to me, I'm always selling as a coach that it's about the type of shot. So I've always tried to avoid then going to numbers and saying, oh, we're only shooting 20%. It's more about the process for me on that side of things. So that's kind of, I guess, why the numbers aren't a help on that front. But definitely the opposition's field goal percentage, I want to know.
Yep.
Like, if they're shooting at above 50%, well, I'm looking at what our defense is doing from that. So, yeah, there's definitely different angles you can go at, and it is a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's what do you value in the game? What do you really want to extract from it?
Well, what's going to paint the best picture for you to make change? So you get to half time and you're down eight. What numbers from the first half are going to help you change your game plan or go to plan B from there? A lot of that is a product of how much resource you have on the bench with you, because if you're the head coach and you have got no assistant coaches, very hard to keep the data. If you've got one assistant or two assistants, as we send off to AJCs, then you can really be pretty scientific in the information that you're tracking. Fouls is a big one, because the score bench get fouls wrong a lot of the time. So you better know how many fouls your best player or your players have.
That sounds like another big whack that Zepp's had one in every week.
Experience this a little bit.
That might have been a chewing out my first year as an assistant. It's good to know. And who can play with two and who cannot play with two fouls comes into that.
That's a great point. Like, I mean, what do you get assistants to track just to be on top of? You know, like, I know when we've worked together, it's been about scoring runs is a big thing for me.
Yep.
The funny thing now in working with Dean is there is no scoring run, it's a gut feel. So that's, again, you know, to me, that number of seven is just a good little checkpoint to go, all right, well, we need to either make change here, or we're looking at, you know, what we're doing. If there's a 7-0 run, I need that assistance to say, hey, we got to think about where we're at.
I watched Barcelona versus Real Madrid last week, and Real started on a 13-0 run, or 11-2, 13-2 run, and no timeout at all. Just let them play through it. Made subs to try and change it. We did lose by 30, but
not all stats tell the truth.
So in game for me, my assistants, and just going by what happened last year in the Big V, I had one of my assistants tracking how many times through the game we got three stops in a row. Like, I thought if we were able to get three stops in a row six or more times, that we probably had a pretty good defensive game.
Yep.
And then the other part to that was, when we were getting scored on, how were we getting scored on? So we had a sheet that we just used to tally up, you know, side on ball, middle on ball, post isolation, draw penetration, like the four or five ones where, you know, we valued that we have to be good at defending these actions or defending these scenarios. And if at halftime we look at it and we're getting scored, and, you know, 70% of the points are coming out of middle on ball, well, the hard show or the trap or whatever is not working, plan B was, now we've got to go and change it. So again, the numbers have to be able to give you some clarity about how we're going to deal with the numbers.
I love the runs of stops, like from a statistic point of view. Like, I've used that, and, you know, last season we were calling them turkeys because three strikes, you know, it's a turkey. And it was just a way that, you know, we got two in a row, the boys would be yelling out turkey, and just another way to lock in and get that third stop. But the great part of three stops in a row, and if your process is good down the other end, the scoreboard's starting to go the way you want, and just that defensive cue and that mindset that the athlete can understand, and I've used that at every age group, like, it doesn't matter how old the athlete is, they're going to understand, well, three stops is a great thing for us.
Yeah.
One of the other things I've used a fair bit is possession charts, just tracking how each possession went, how many possessions are we getting, are we playing at the right pace. I always like to know how many times have we run a certain action for the game and how many points have we got out of it. Like, if we can see that, hey, we've been using dribble handoffs, you know, every time we've run that we've scored, but we haven't used it for two quarters and we're not getting scores, why can't we go back to that?
I even think it can be even simpler than that in tracking, you know, 3-point shots, mid-range, free throw, second chance. So that, you know, I'm sure we've all been in that game where you just feel like someone's shooting the lights out on you, but then in reality they've only made two this quarter and it's not that bad. Where, or the other way, we make a couple shots, then we go on this big drought, we've taken five threes in a row and we need some more heat on the rim. Being able to track those things definitely can matter in real time.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, as you say, like the Big V level and higher, you get a box score, so it's really easy. But I think, Mike, you made the point of, you know, you need an assistant sitting there taking stats, but you need to make sure that everyone understands what an assist is, what a turnover is, whose turnover it is as well. Like, the definition of a stat can matter a fair bit as well. It's not as simple as, well, they threw the ball out of court, so that's a turnover on that kid. That might be, well, they only threw the ball out of court because the other kid didn't catch it.
Right.
Like, it's not necessarily like for like.
I think that's where stats can lie to you. Like, it's going to be a combination of both. It's interesting, I was listening to a rival pod that was talking about, you know, the NBA advanced stats now, and that it's almost going too far because coaches are still referring back to the simplistic parts of, you know, turnovers, field goal percentage, those sorts of things. And I think the point that I'm trying to make there is it's got to be one, what you can decipher. So there's no point looking at true shooting percentage if you don't understand what that is, you know, or how to derive that yourself. Likewise, if you know, offensive rebounding is to you is an indicator of how hard your team's playing, then okay, figure out how you're breaking that data down. That to me is it's an awesome world that it's going into, where the numbers are really making us look at the game a different way. But again, it's like, you know, the scouting pod we had last week. If you're not going to use the video, well, then it doesn't help your cause. So figuring that out is pretty important.
Yeah,
you touched on an important point there. Numbers can lie. Like, if you don't have enough data, well, you might be taking one box score and seeing one kid go 5 or 6 from the 3-point line and think that kid's the shooter. And it's like, well, actually, they're not. They just had a night out.
Yeah.
It can lie to you at times. Well, I know I've certainly been guilty of, we've looked at stats during a tournament, which is maybe, what, 7 or 8 games long, kid's shot the ball really poorly and all of a sudden shoots the lights out in a final. And it's like, well, our scout tells us we don't need to carry a hand there, or we can, you know, go short closeouts and all of a sudden we get lit up. Yeah. And it's a different world.
Absolutely. Happened to me as a player at North Texas. I remember it was like my fourth or fifth game. The scout was go under this on-ball screen with the opposition point guard because he was 1 for 15 going into the game. He saw me and went 4 for 4 in the first half and felt better about himself. I know Shula talks about, that was a Tommy Wright last year.
Tommy Wright touches
so the scout on Tommy Wright was to go under. He goes 5 for 6 in the first half, yeah, and the game's essentially done. So the numbers, they can get you beat as well. So that's just a
so thing. How long do you last before you change? I suppose the next part, like, how long do you trust the numbers saying, no, they will miss eventually, or this will change for us, before you sit there and go, well, actually, we have to change?
The one thing that the numbers will never tell you is how a guy's feeling. So if he does go 4 for 4 early, you're rolling the dice if you don't think he's going to go 8 for 10 for the day.
I think you've got to go and feel sometimes, and you can have the best laid out plan from the numbers, but if that isn't working that night, that's coaching. You've got to make adjustments, you've got to change it and try something else. One of the other ones that I've always used is time versus score margin. So if there are more points on the board than there is less time, I've got to change what we're doing to be able to have a chance in it. So looking at those sorts of things to just give yourself a chance. We would have had the best plan I've ever put together, maybe, but it's not working. Right. Don't be stubborn, like, find a way to change it. The cool part about, I just want to kind of go sidetrack here, like, where I think the numbers part and the analytics now is really kind of cool is working out how you gain advantages or where your disadvantage might be. So if looking at the numbers and how many times a team scoring out of a post or a turnout action, kind of like what you said, Zap, that to me is really where the numbers can help you. So going a bit different from just a box score now, and you can do it off the box score, you know, like if a team's putting up 33s a game, chances are you're going to have to run them off the three-point line. Like, there is ways around that, but if you can then couple the video work you did last week and now kind of start statting, well, you know, middle on ball, they're in that action, you know, a third of the time, they score out of it then half the time, that's probably something you've got to worry about and take care of. Whereas when they throw in the post, they're 0 of 11 in their last six games, that's a pretty good sample size. I might try and funnel the ball into the post and let them play. So using that sort of data now to really shape how you're going to play that following week. Right. Same deal out of ball screen. Can they defend it on the side? They're poor at it. Like, using those numbers now to gain that competitive advantage.
Shapes your game plan, shapes how you practice through the week. Like, the numbers will dictate what drills and how you are instructing your athletes to defend certain actions. Or offensively, you know, we found out that they can't handle A, B, and C, so we've got to be really good at A, B, and C this week. We're going to play fast because they're a poor defensive transition team, whatever that is. The numbers have to lead you to action. Like, you've got, if you do take the numbers, then you've got to be prepared to use them and believe that they're going
to
work.
And I guess the hardest part of that is it's very time consuming to do that.
Right.
You know, one of the tools we'll use at an NBL level is Synergy. Or in our international events. So, you know, fortunate enough, that gets taken care of for you. So we know how many times, like, an Ed Kasosa is going to be in middle on ball and what he's going to do off it. That's some data that's really helpful for your individual scout. But you can do it at a simplistic form, and I think that's more relevant to it, to our listeners. Like, just figure out, you know, split the court into three areas. Simple as that. Now, are they scoring in the middle cylinder or the sides? Well, if they're a really good team in the middle cylinder, find a way to get them on the outside. Like, little things like that, you can do. It doesn't have to be that high tech or that advanced.
It can be done with players too. If you notice that one certain player always has the ball in their hands, but there are four other guys out there that don't really seem to touch it too much, well, take away that one player. Like, you can start to see the usage rates as well. And every time the ball gets through this kid's hands and that becomes a two-man game between their shooting guard and their big, bad things happen. So take that away and make someone else do some damage.
And figuring out the disruption point you need. So often, you know, Zep's got a great stat coming up about, you know, how many reversals of the ball, but often, you know, like the feeder pass or whoever's responsible for off that cutting action, getting them the ball, that can be a great disruption point. So understanding those sorts of things from the data can really help you in a game sense.
You want to jump in on
this? We want the stat?
We want the stat.
We want the man love stat with, you know, your boy.
The listeners know a soft spot for Brad Stevens. So he, when he was at Butler, did a little bit of analytics on offensive possessions and points per possession based on number of ball reversals. So he broke it down into having zero ball reversals, one ball reversal, or two ball reversals. And the differences were, so points per possession is, for the listeners, based on 100 possessions,
yep.
Just because every team plays at a different pace. So to have a standard, they've made it based on 100 possessions. He found out that with zero ball reversals, they would score 0.63 points per 100 possessions, one ball reversal, 0.83, and then 1.1 points per possession when they had two ball reversals. So I guess it helped him sell the message to his team that we need to get the ball from, you know, first side, second side, back to the third side, and we would get the best quality shot that we could possibly get.
And that's another way that numbers can help, is, you know, you're coming up with a scheme or you've got a belief and your athletes may be resisting a little bit on that. You know, having numbers can always be there to help you. Support, it doesn't just have to be a fact-finding thing.
Mm.
The one that it's kind of got me thinking that I want to look into is points per possession against zone defense.
Mm.
When the ball is just swung around and kicked up versus actually gets in the paint before that shot goes up. My gut feel is it's a lot better on that, but I want to find out now if the data supports that. And so again, just another way for, you know, basketball IQ, I guess, you know, that's just triggered my thought on that.
So Justin will track that for us this year with his Kilsyth group and roughly term three.
Well, they know back with the numbers. They know the rules on that one, so
doesn't necessarily mean it always happens.
No, that's true. That's true.
So talking mainly sort of junior levels now, do you think it's healthy for players to see a box score after the game, or is it something you sort of try and avoid if you can help it? Kids and parents, I suppose, put a lot of weight in stats. Is it healthy to let them see that, or do you try and keep them away from it?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. The VJBL now, or even junior leagues around Australia, have, you know, Sporting Pulse or TG or whoever it is tracking points scored in games. Now, I know a lot of teams have, and I see it on Friday nights, we'll have someone sitting on the bench taking stats of the game, which I'm sure would get published on the group Facebook side or whatever it is. So
Facebook, because Apple's on that too, like, he's across social media.
There is, if that is possible, if you can do that. But yeah, I mean, I think the numbers are important. Like, as an athlete, I think it is important to see the numbers. You don't need to share it with them. You don't need to share it with the under 14 athlete 10 minutes after the game, I wouldn't think.
I'd go a different angle on it, and that's part of coaching, I think, is if you can get, one, your athletes to understand it is a team game, and so these are the stats that matter for our team success. So I think an athlete looking at a box score and looking at offensive rebounding comparison, turnover comparison, yeah, field goal percentage comparison, all those sorts of things, I think there's a real great teaching aid in that.
Mm.
If the first thing they're looking at is how many points they got, the second thing I'd be pointing at is how many shots they took to get those points. So if little Mike Zeppel's gone 9 of 10 for his huge tally, then all right, good job, mate. Like, well done. But if he is now 9 of 48, like a Kobe Bryant box score, then I would be, you know, again, it's a teaching aid. So I think I'm kind of always the other way, and I don't think you want to necessarily hide it, but you do need to educate it. I keep finding ways to use things to help an athlete out.
Yeah. So what numbers are you collecting that's going to help your athlete develop? Like, is it closeouts? Is it sprinting to the, jumping to the ball? Like, is that what you're tracking to help with the development of your athletes, as opposed to this is how many points everyone scored? This is the stat sheet.
And that's the hard part. Like, I know being at Nationals, there have been plenty of times where kids being kids, they jump in the bus, the first thing they do is go straight to the live stats on their phone, check the box score as to what it looked like. So we tried to make it a little bit of a healthy competition with some of our kids in terms of, okay, let's not track points or shot attempts or anything like that. Let's track, I think it was turnovers, free throw percentage and rebounds. And we split them into two teams, and we said, right, you guys are playing against the other guys. Whichever team has the best free throw percentage, you get a one. If you have the best, you know, offensive rebound rate, you get a one. If you have turnovers, well, that's a negative. And whoever got the win had to make the other team breakfast. So we made it a little bit of a healthy competition. Like coaches won every day. That was the one thing that remained constant. But that was a way that we sort of said, well, okay, you can look at the box score, but we want you looking at some key things rather than points.
I had a measly playing contract once with a club where it was stat based, but the interesting part that the coach did was points. You didn't get a payment for a point, but you did get a good payment for charges, offensive rebounds, like the stats that mattered to that coach. And
you went hungry for a while.
Yeah, it was interesting year. But like again, going back to your point, Zep, as well about what do you stat. At the end of the day, whatever a coach feels is going to be value-adding for the athletes is what you've got to do. And one of the things that you kind of touched on it then, Zep, practice stats. So they're not, you know, there's no true shooting stats in that or whatever for me. But what it is how many deflections, you know, how many blow-bys have you given up? How many hockey assists have you given? Like, those sorts of things, I think. So now you're building your system and your culture and what you want players to be like.
Hockey assists for those players.
Well, there's two ways that we would do it. It'd be the extra pass. So you're not launching it, you're making the extra one. Or if you're the player that's created the extra. So I've penetrated, I've got 2 feet in the paint, I've created the opportunity for defense to shift. You can get a hockey assist on that. If you're a post player and same deal, it's gone in, it's come out, looking at that. Deflections, obviously, just any time we get a hand on the ball. And I know a lot of high-end coaches have used deflections as an indicator of how hard they're playing their D. I think, you know, Patino was probably the first one I heard talking about
he's
that.
He's not allowed on coaching podcasts.
We don't want to talk about him, but I know I 100% know that when our deflection rates are up, generally speaking, we're getting more runs of stops, which then means we're winning quarters, which then means we're winning games. So it is a trickle-down effect just from that one.
Well, and deflections really tie into disrupt.
Yeah,
I suppose it's the big way of doing it. Like, you're making that offense as clunky as you can. You're not allowing them to go 2 ball reversals. You're getting a stop after one, knocking it out of court. Then it's a side ball or a baseline ball rather than something else. So deflections are a really key one. I know heaps of coaches that really buy into deflections. It's a really big one.
So we should get to the real big part of it, right?
And what were your stats as a junior?
No, definitely not that. Is understanding like why the game is changing so much, I think. And stats have really driven this. And I know my coaching philosophy has really gone heavily because of this. And understanding what shots are the best shots in basketball. And if you ask an under 10 kid that today, they're probably going to say the half court heave.
Yeah, absolutely.
But understanding, I think it's really important for coaches. And I know my time in Tassie that first year, getting people down there to understand that the 3-point shot was a great thing. That was a wrestle. Like, that was really tough. But, you know, free throws are the highest points per possession. Hands down, the best shot in basketball we can get. Now, common sense says, well, that's because it's uncontested. But it is. The more times you get to the free throw line, the better chance of conversion you have per 100 possessions. Next is 3-point shot. So again, I can make less threes than I make twos to get a better outcome. So simple math on that. That's why the 3-point shot matters. And basically everything outside of that is last on it. Zeb, you got some stats there though from the Houston Rockets that really spell that out, and they've really gone to the nth degree on this from a purely an analytical point.
Yeah, so, and we'll go through towards the end of the pod some really cool data resources that are online that you can tinker around with yourself. But this one's called NBA Miner, like you're mining for data, and they've analysed over the last kind of decade the distance of shots that NBA teams have predominantly shot. So they're broken down into 8 feet and closer to the basket. So anything inside 8 feet.
It's a layup.
Anything 8 feet to 24 feet. So mid-range, we would call it. And then 24 feet and beyond, which would be 3-point and a step beyond that. And the Houston Rockets this year have shot only 11% of their shots for the whole year between 8 feet and 24 feet. So When you think about that, it is either Capella on the ring dunk or Harden layup, or it is a three-point shot by somebody. Everything else is not what they're looking for, and that ties into their philosophy. If you compare that...
Currently today, they're number one in the NBA, right?
Correct.
Wins and losses. So correct. There's something in that for sure.
If you compare, have James Harden and Hope.
Yeah, good players.
Yeah.
Compare that to 2012. They shot a total of 34% of their shots in the mid-range, between 8 and 24 feet. So change of coaching staff, brought a new philosophy, obviously. But that is how it has changed over the course of time. Just some of the teams that they're comparing with, like the Dallas Mavericks have shot 29% of their shots from the mid-range this year. Denver Nuggets, 19%. Detroit shot 26% of their shots mid-range. The Warriors are an interesting one. So we look at Klay launching threes. We look at Steph Curry launching threes. They've shot 35% of their shots 8 feet and closer. They've shot 30% of their shots in the mid-range, and they've shot 34% of their shots in the three. So they're actually a pretty equal split between the three distances. Again, the philosophy is a little bit different. They do shoot the three, but it's not the be-all and end-all for them.
I had a great discussion with Brad Davidson a while back when he was the national shooting coach, and talking about the mid-range game was still really prevalent in the women's game. And he was talking more because there's a lot more long closeouts and that ability to get to that comfort spot. If you've got a team that is really elite at mid-range, and I've heard some guys from the Rockets talk about Chris Paul, great at pull-up mid-range, they're not going to say no to it. It's just not something they look for. And recruitment and all those sorts of things build on that to then turn them into what they are this season. And again, it comes down to your coaching philosophy, how you feel, what's going to be the next shift in the game, who knows. But I think those stats really paint a great picture of what we're trying to say, and that data can help you understand how you can increase your points per possession.
I think the really important thing to keep in mind is that a shot in rhythm is significantly higher percentage than a shot out of rhythm and a contested shot.
Absolutely.
So your in rhythm short corner jumper uncontested is a higher percentage shot than a contested two at the basket and a contested three wherever it is. So your ability to create rhythm shots for your team has to be the number one priority for you offensively, and how you do that in the spots of the floor, that's your choice based on your philosophy. But for me, you can just see games and players change when they're able to shoot rhythm jump shots, and I think that's important to keep in mind.
I think the 3-point is a little dangerous. I know there's been plenty of times where a team's got on a 4 or 6 point run, you're not necessarily looking for that next shot that you guys take to be an open three, or just a three in general. Like normally the instruction from the coach is get it inside, get a high percentage shot, and this is where the data can lie at times.
Straight away, I think the term should be, let's try and get to the foul line, because that's actually the highest points per possession. So that to me is where that mentality goes.
But you don't tend to get to the foul line shooting threes.
No, and that's right.
Unless
you're James Harden. So the mindset needs to go, and that's where your system builds. Like for us in country, it's feet in the paint before a three can go up. And that's purely that.
Yep.
We want to get to the foul line.
Post-catch counts as feet in the paint, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. And that's, again, a chance for them to go score and go with it. To talk about the contested shot and rhythm shots and all those sorts of things, like another stat we've been coaching in BV's high performance for a long time is making sure you're contesting shots. Just getting a hand up matters. And, the numbers on that are getting a hand up means about 22 less points per 100 possessions. So just being near a shooter, just contesting a shot, my sell to an athlete is that worth it if it's going to reduce the chance of success? And absolutely it is. So again, using data to now sell to the athletes, but also building our way that we want to play in making two-hand contests, don't put people to the foul line, really getting that understanding is where a lot of this data is helping out.
Yeah, and that's why coaches lose it when they see one of their kids close out and just watch that ball sail over their head, because just the simple lifting of the hand to be the second jumper off the floor can change the game as well.
Well, and the other part to that's actually from the Philadelphia 76ers, and the other part is the later you go in a shot clock, the more contested the shot becomes. Now, we had a really nice little chat about that before we went on the pod, but you know, most teams will switch late clock, so now you're in front and it turns into a more contested shot. The interesting thing when I, you know, every time I think about that is most teams will bring someone to the ball late clock, so that brings congestion, brings more chance for a contested shot. So maybe we're actually doing that the wrong way around, and it should be spread the floor and space out and try and create a one-on-one opportunity.
Yeah.
But that's for another pod, Rob.
It might be.
That discussion.
It might be. Do you guys use shot charts at all with the statistics? So have a look at where they're getting their shots from, what types of shots they're taking. Like, it's a really heavy three-point team versus, you know, they're a pound the ball. And do you guys use them at all or not?
I think it paints a bit of a philosophical picture of the other team. So if you can see that, you know, it's pretty heated in the paint, then you're definitely going to be pretty cognizant of post defense for that opposition.
Cognizant.
I'm bringing the big words out, right?
Yeah. Didn't stutter either.
Yeah, it was very sharp.
And then, yeah, same with you, if you see corner threes pretty heated, or you know, it just helps you paint that picture.
Yeah, purely for scouting purposes and review purposes. So, in view of us, I do check our shot chart and just kind of see. I prefer to actually look at the quarter by quarter one to kind of see where, you know, if, say we did lose it, what did that quarter look like when we only scored 12 points, and, you know, just get a better understanding of us from that. But definitely for scouting, like trying to figure out, you know, what they're really trying to achieve with their actions and go from there.
Probably one of the other things I like to look at as well is which side of the floor do teams start their offense on.
Absolutely.
Well, there's a lot of teams that are very right-hand dominant or right-hand side dominant.
Yep.
That will be potentially to get a ball reversal and have someone come off an on-ball back on their right hand, whatever the case may be. But I think that's a really valuable one as well that I love to stat.
Yep.
Is how many teams will start offenses on either side of the floor.
Yep. Or in the middle of the floor. Like we have known for a long time against European teams, we've got to get them out of the middle because they're going to run a horns action or a floppy action or something that gets them into their, basically their flow actions from there. So yeah, understanding that, again, it's about competitive advantage.
Yep. And I mean, touching on that competitive advantage, you were with a Oz team a couple of years ago against New Zealand. Played them early in the week and things did not go to plan.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that.
Tanking? Is this what he's talking about? He tanked against
on the international.
It definitely wasn't tanking, but what I will say about that game was we knew we were going to play them in the gold medal game, so we definitely didn't want to show everything that we were doing, and we basically lived in one action. And what we hadn't figured out at that point in time was how to really negate their punch screen action. So we trialled some stuff in that game, and by no means did we want that margin to be what the margin was, but we weren't hell-bent on throwing everything out there and showing our full hand in that. That said, I'm not sure where the question is about that.
Well, no. The question being that you guys felt that you couldn't necessarily run with their bigs. Like, if this became a slow-down game, this did not suit your style necessarily as much as it suited their style.
No, yeah,
so you guys had to change how you played as well.
Yeah, and again, that was about trying to figure out how can we manipulate who they are to our advantage versus let them be who they are. And fortunately enough, that worked in our favour. But
shot the ball fairly well.
We shot the ball very well. We changed our defence quite a bit, and it turned out to be pretty good.
Yep, that makes sense. So, lineup analytics, do you guys use it at all? Do you not touch it? Like, I mean, there's plus minus attached to all these sorts of things as well. Like, I know the first time I saw plus minus was probably 10-ish years ago, I think it was. We had a parent in our team that was pretty good with, hey, when you've got this five on court at the same time, you're plus six. When you've, coincidentally, yes, their son was in that lineup. When you don't have that crew on, you're a minus four. Do you guys trust that at all or not really?
That's what the athletes like to look at, is
absolutely.
The plus minus. Look at my plus when I'm on the floor, coach put me in. And I know a lot of NBA players have contracts tied to plus minuses as well, which is really interesting. I think, again, all it does is supplement your gut feel, because the plus minus can also be skewed. If you're in the game at the end of the game, you're a starter and you're playing with four bench guys and the other team goes on a 10-0 run, that hurts your plus minus, and we might already be up by 25 and coach is just trying to get everyone some runs. So how you take those numbers, again, you have to be careful how deep you analyse them.
Yeah, like, I don't have a lot of belief's the wrong word, but I don't put a lot of weight on it. I trust it and I read it. To me, the interesting part is most of the lineups you'll see that are the best are a guy off the bench with four starters. And I've often thought about, well, why is that? Well, generally speaking, they're with the better players on the floor, but they're coming in nice and fresh with the talented athletes. When that player is then, you know, spending more, if they were the player that spent more time with a full bench lineup, that's going to be a tougher game for them. So I try not to read too much into it, but I do agree with Zep that often it will reaffirm what you are feeling. I think what I like to use data lineups for more so is understanding what is our most disruptive lineup, what is our best rebounding lineup, those sorts of things, versus just trying to figure out, well, who am I going to play tonight? I think it's more useful if, you know, for a special needs sort of situation.
And those things can be skewed as well by what the other team's got on the floor at the same time.
Absolutely.
So it's all well and good for someone to pad their stats coming in when you're playing against the bench, but that's a very different world when you're playing your starters.
You talk about NBA I've never heard that, contracts are, how do you know how that is done?
I was listening to a pod or a TV show or something, and the same way like running backs in the NFL had, you know, 1,000 yards, 2,000 yards are you know, contract milestones, certain plus minuses tied into NBA contracts, which is interesting.
It is. 2 for 1. So I know you've spoken before, 34-ish seconds I think is yours roughly. Does the data suggest that is the way to play?
It's definitely, well, again, it's another possession. So the more possessions you have to score, the better chance of the result. But what I would say heavily is it depends what your group is. So my Kilsyth group last year, we started in that world and it didn't work out too well. So we ended up changing that a little bit. So I think it is indicative of who your lineup is and who you've got. But as a general rule, 2 for 1 is what we will go for. And we do it with United. You know, I know when we play New Zealand, they'll do it like most teams around the world will. The one thing that has changed, and I saw this with Pop at the Spurs, is not putting up a bad shot in a 2 for 1 for the sake of a 2 for 1. So he'd actually rather just turn it over or throw it out and get that defensive possession and still get it back versus kicking up something bad. And I actually think they do that late clock now as well, that even if it's one shot, if they can't get a good look, they'd rather just hold on to it and get a shot clock violation, because that goes into their D-trans rules of just having 5 back. They believe that that's going to be the best outcome.
Yeah,
so
that's my challenge to it, is you got to know your group, and is a contested shot with 34 seconds to go on the clock, does that really help the cause? So yeah, same, you know, in rhythm, shoot shots, but you wouldn't force a contested shot just to get a 2 for 1,
yeah,
and then give up a bucket in transition on the other end.
It ties in a little bit to what we spoke about last week on the split with fouling.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is probably where this has come from, I'd suggest. Just the analytics behind it. There's plenty of data out there online that people can go and have a look at. A lot of it is a fairly closely guarded secret, like the really good stuff probably is. But there's some great websites out there as well that you can just tap into straight away. One I use a fair bit is Captain Calculator, which is a fantastic name in all honesty.
Captain Calculator.
So you can punch in all sorts of stats. You can get your assist to turnover ratio, your rebound percentage, your pace, your rebound rate, how many possessions, and your true shooting percentage. That's a website I've used fairly regularly, and it is free, which is always the best price.
We love free, man.
We do.
But we want you to buy this podcast.
Yeah, if you can. Another article I loved was the Grantland article on how do rebounds work. It's got a graph. I love graphs and all sorts of things like that.
A graph if you're from other parts of the world.
Yeah, South Australia doesn't count. Which is great because it shows on there, okay, if we shoot the ball from this point on the floor, where should the rebound go to? And it'll give you a little bit of a statistic around that as well. Plenty of apps you can use to take stats. So obviously not everyone has the ability to use a full-on statistician for their games. Through the App Store, not to be confused with where the podcasts sit, which is where we are. But on the App Store, there's a couple that I've used. Hoop Stats, iScout Basketball, Hoop Metrics, Breakthrough Stats, and iTouch Basketball have always been ones that I've used.
Basketball Manager's a good one as well for stats that I've hit up, and I'm pretty sure it might be a $2.99 charge, but it's worth the $2.99 if you can afford it.
Any other things that you guys have used or websites to hit up?
For me, the main ones are Spatial Jam and Real GM, just from that side of things, and we've already spoken about Synergy. Again, though, these aren't as free as your calculator, Captain, but really good Captain for Calculator, data, mate, Captain Calculator. Right. Spatial Jam actually goes right down to Siebel level as well, so I'm sure there's quite a few people that are listening that already are aware of that. And Basketball Reference, I think, is another one that we all have been on.
Ken Pom's the other one. I used it when I was in the US. Justin thinks it's skewed when his Tar Heels are not painted in the most favourable light, but it's actually a pretty cool look at just the numbers that he values as a bit of a number cruncher, and talks about tempo and how that affects offensive and defensive efficiency, and for the colleges, how strength of schedule overall plays into it, which is a bit of a crapshoot. So
that's where I'm saying it's a little skewed, because of the way the cupcake schedules are put out there by some schools versus the real schools. But absolutely, again, take out of it what you want to and what you need.
Another website which is interesting, I got sent through by Jack Fleming, another friend of the show that regularly contributes to us. Cleaningtheglass.com is a great read as well. It's got a couple of analytics articles on there as well as a few guys that are actually involved in the NBA and how they got their start and what they did to sort of get involved in it, which is a great look as well.
Works for nothing.
That's exactly what it is.
I actually saw a few jobs advertised in the last week, like interns for NBA teams. There was a Lakers job, I think there was a Dallas Mavericks job for basketball.
Two losing teams.
Basketball analytics interns, which is interesting because the US, in the pro leagues around the world, there's definitely a need for these people now. I think it's a pretty cool space to be in.
It's like every tier of sport. There was a period of time where teams didn't have strength coaches, and then everyone figured out that's a pretty good idea. Same with nutritionists. Analytics is part of the game, whether you like it or not. And the more you can create competitive advantage, especially in your top leagues around the place, it's a point of difference. So you're going to see that more and more. And the cool thing about all of this is how many more basketball jobs are evolving of late, and worldwide, but more so in our own country, in our own space. The way the NBL is going, and just every association in Victoria now seems to have a coaching director, and there's just a lot of good things happening. And if this is another angle, albeit, let's do it.
I think it's a great space to get into. Not everyone can have Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill wandering around, but obviously there's some Moneyball stuff that you can do with it as well. Favourite Jonah Hill movie?
Yeah, Moneyball.
Moneyball for you? What do you got?
Superbad's pretty much right there as well. But it is a sports podcast. Yeah. So.
Who's Jonah Hill?
Except doesn't get out, mate.
Yeah, not at all. Just reads basketball books all day, I'm told.
So I guess the pointy end of all this is what the pro leagues would call advanced analytics. And that's the data that they put together based generally on 100 possessions of a game, and what they find as the numbers that will determine how they're supposed to play versus a particular opposition, or how their style of play or basketball philosophy comes into it. So there's a few different...
Recruitment's
a big one, absolutely. So there's a few of them that you'll see on these websites that we've gone through. Points per possession is a really big one. We spoke about the Brad Stevens metric before. Offensive and defensive ratings, like how do you rate up against the other teams in your league giving up points per 100 possessions, because tempos are different. And the other one is effective field goal percentage, which you've spent a bit of time with.
Yeah, and I guess it's probably the out of all this, the one that everyone can kind of do in their back pocket. Field goal attempts plus 0.5 multiplied by your 3-point makes divided by field goal attempts. At the end of it, you can figure out per player, per team, whatever it needs to be. But I know that effective field goal percentage is the number one recruiting tool in international competition now. So it's outside of everything else. they all want to know what that is. So,
and that's a bit of a combination between your ability to make twos and threes.
Yeah, it's, right? It's a total look at your shooting ability, per se. So, you know, in essence, if you're trying to figure out if little Johnny or little Robbie, I should use this time,
can actually, for about 15 years, mate.
Can actually help you kicking the ball up every time. There's an equation there that you can definitely look into. But for us, we feel the advanced analytics one definitely needs to be a lengthy pot of its own. And we're very fortunate to have a couple of people that operate in that field on a day-to-day that will join us on the pod sometime soon.
Yep.
So time for everyone's favourite part of the segment, the split, the kick and the extra. Feel free to send in a sponsorship for this and we'll get some swag together for anyone that wants to send in emails.
Just send one in.
Yeah, or just send us checks. It's just leave a bag on the front doorstep of the BV office and we'll pick it up on the way through. It's just as good. So the split for this week, Mike, you are the, you must agree with this statement for this week, the affirmative. Justin, you are the negative.
The negative, all right. Negative. So I go second.
Correct, you do. So, given our talk about data and analytics, there is no point in practicing mid-range jump shots in workouts anymore. It's completely part of the game that is no longer relevant to us. We should only shoot threes and layups when working out. Mike, off you go.
60 seconds starts now. Completely irrelevant. We've just gone through. The Houston Rockets painted an unbelievable picture that we need to be really, really good inside of 8 feet. Really, really good beyond the three-point line, and between that, you should be able to shoot enough shots in rhythm, uncontested, with space on the floor to where your athletes are able to shoot the ball in the hole. That means that the one dribble pull-up without getting into the paint is not necessary in practice, Robbie. Your under 12 fours cannot be doing that at practice.
They don't anyway, mate.
That's good. Good coaching. Your crossover move into, you know, pull-up jumpers are irrelevant. Get 2 feet in the paint, pass the ball to the person who's open in the corner, who'll make that little hockey assist that Shula loves as well, catch and shoot that ball in rhythm. So, you know, I'd be shooting. And we, all jokes aside, inside the paint is a real struggle with junior basketball. Now, we see it at a BJBL level. We'll see it at a national level when we go to Geelong and up north for the 16s, that the paint, finishing in the paint, is still not something that we've mastered as a junior, as junior athletes here in Australia. So, all jokes aside, it still does need a lot of work.
He's making my argument.
So what we're hearing from Mike though is the mid-range game is dead.
Yeah, gone.
Yeah,
gone. Get good in the paint.
So Justin, you disagree. The mid-range game is alive and well, and it is something that you believe in. Go.
Oh, Michael, you're always wrong in these. yes, I agree. The three-point line matters. I also agree that layups matter, but if you come up against a defense that is taking those things away from you, what do you have left? What you have left, my friend, is mid-range game. Mid-range game. You just touched on it and gave me the answer that I had written down as you were wafting on there. The ability to make floaters, to finish in just that little bit of a distance out, drops defense is a big part of most team strategies on ball screen D now. Being able to come off and make a floater runner at that mid-range point, a little pull-up, Jimmy, that is definitely needed to be in the skill package for any athlete. What about our post-playing friends? Catching at the high post, making a jab step, getting into the middle of the lane, a little short roll off the screen. That mid-range game, my friend, is definitely well and truly alive.
You've done well, but you're 0 for 5 now in 5 weeks.
Well, we'll continue with you then, Justin. The kick. This is on you this week.
The kick. My God, the kick. If anyone is following the NCAA debacle, where coaches are allowed to just take whatever they want, ask for money left, right and centre.
Contracts.
And different athletes are getting hurt by it. The FBI stuff, if you haven't been following it, it is worth a lengthy read. It just amazes me, and we've all been in this situation in the chairs here where a college coach will approach us about an Aussie talent, promise the world. In my time, no one has ever discussed money, but for that to be going on and us to still be able to have faith to say to an athlete that comes to us, yep, you should take that scholarship and go for it, that to me is kind of concerning at this point in time with how much of it's going on.
Yeah. maybe that hopefully the positive out of this is that it does now create some dialogue. And I know LeBron James tipped in yesterday about the NCAA. Like, maybe this does open up the dialogue to where the NCAA can have a look at what is actually going to work and benefit everyone. Because the coach making $4 million a year is living a pretty good life. I just get concerned with the kid at the dormitory who still has to tip his own money in to wash his clothes. So there has to be some kind of dialogue open for us to figure out how to make this a benefit for everybody. And if we're talking about, you know, men's basketball and football, which are the money-making sports, how does that affect your golfers, your hockey players, your swimmers as well, who are in the same situation? So
exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's not a new problem. You know, you go back to the Michigan days with the Fab Five, and they're looking around at, you know, how all these people are making money from them and their likeness and their image. It's crazy how much the athletes almost not get exploited but get used in this situation.
The one thing that I do feel uncomfortable with that is people aren't valuing the price of an education. And a lot of athletes don't get the opportunity to get educated to that level without these scholarships. So there is a fine line. The thing that I really struggle with, though, is basically lying and cheating going on to get recruits, and then the coaches often just washing their hands and pretending like they didn't know. Like, that's the part for me that I really struggle with when we are helping Aussie athletes get over to college. So that's definitely my kick. Get your stuff sorted out. Almost dropped it then. And go with it. But, boys, I have a bonus kick. Just noticed recently a number of other, since our followings, what's it at last week? 5,000 downloads. Just noticed a lot more.
That's per episode. That's not total.
No, yeah. That was the episode last week, right? Yeah. So just noticing a lot of other little coaching podcasts popping up from our rival Sporting Codes and some from our own rival states. So we wish you luck. Not that, you'll need
it.
Not
the best of luck.
It won't work for you, but no, we're glad we're having a positive impact on coaching in all facets. But yeah, don't give them good ratings. That's all we're asking.
The word trailblazer has been used multiple times by multiple people, and we are not them. But, you know, just good luck to everyone.
No, we had to put it somewhere. Yeah, so, exactly. You know, plagiarism's flattery, isn't it? So there you go.
Absolutely.
The extra, Mike.
It's not all doom and gloom. The extra is that today is March 1, so this is the start of March Madness. Conference tournaments will kick off tomorrow. Next Sunday, Selection Sunday, the tournament will start the weekend after. It is a great time of the year, all FBI investigations aside. But it really is when you know the games are on, dawn till dusk, and then that ends up going into the NBA playoffs. Like, the next kind of 2.5 months is a really cool time to be a basketball follower. And I know we'll see some really awesome stuff.
It's fair to say there's not much work being done in here, is there, when it's March Madness and NBA Finals?
Not sure. We don't see much of Justin in this office.
We might do a March Madness pod in a couple of weeks.
That might be a good way to go about it. So that's us done for this week. Again, please do rating, review, iTunes,
retweet,
Audio Boom, retweet to get Zep on Twitter.
Let's get Zep on Twitter.
Just for everyone, he does have an account. He just refuses to post. He's that creepy stalker that sits in the corner
and looks at everything. He's like Donald Trump on his post, so it's worth it.
They'll come. I haven't got the tick yet.
Next week we are out on location again with another legendary Australian coach, which will be a little bit of fun for us. We won't tell you guys who it is. We'll wait and surprise you in the time. Catch you guys next week, and good luck with your coaching.
Good luck.